We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
There's all kinds of things in that introduction there that are always applicable. It's a lot of it. We do have a drug problem in New Hampshire, an opioid problem. There are a lot of problems and opportunities in New Hampshire. And we have, of course, the main focus is all at the top of the ticket, but not that far under the top. There's U.S. Senate, governor, and executive council, also known as governor's council. Kind of an anachronism, some people say, but the current counselor for the Seacoast area is Chris Sununu, and he is running for governor. He's got some ambition. Chris Sununu is Chris Sununu. So it's an open seat, and we have with us today a candidate, Democratic candidate for that seat, Joshua Borden. Joshua, thank you so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Bert. I really appreciate it. Excited to talk with you and, you know, to create some awareness about everything we're doing.
Yeah.
You know, just looking forward to having a conversation.
Well, there's a lot that is going on. And for those who don't know, I mean, it's not exactly the highest profile race, and people don't even know what the executive council is. In 2014, Joshua Borden was elected counselor at large for the town of Derry, a conservative part of the area. He was representative to the Human Services Department, the Safety Department, School Facilities Committee, and the Southern New Hampshire Hazardous Materials Aid District. And in 2015, he was recipient of the Edward M. Kennedy Award for Legislator of the Year by New Hampshire Young Democrats. Well, first off, what is the Executive Council, and why are you running for it?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I spend a large majority of my time explaining exactly that. So I think it's a great opportunity to get right into it. The Executive Council, although many people are not familiar with it, is extremely important. We are one of the only states in the country with one. It dates back to the beginning of, you know, the days of the Queen, and it was designed to keep a check on the governor. We are an advise and consent board. We appoint judges and other high-ranking officials, and we also vote on any and all contracts over $10,000. So at the state level, that is, I mean, that's nearly all of them. That's a lot of them. We have, and I'm not talking about any person in particular, but New Hampshire's governor is the weakest of all the governors in the country because of this executive council. New Hampshire's executive council is split up by district, and it's based on population. So, you know, District 3, the seat I'm running for, is the southeast part of the state. It's about 260,000 people, all in one tight cluster. District 1, where, you know, former Councilor Ray Burton used to, you know, held the seat for many years, is the largest district because there's not as many people living, you know, in district, or the 260,000 are spread out across a majority of the state. Well, does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a big, so I know that the state Senate, where I had the pleasure of working for a long time, represented each district 1/24th of the state. So the executive council represents a fifth of the state.
You got it.
And what are the big towns in the district? Obviously, Derry, where you live.
Yeah, so there's 32 communities, Derry being the largest, about 33,000 people, Portsmouth being the only city, about 25,000 people. You've got Hampton, Newmarket, Newcastle, Exeter, Stratham, Hampstead, Salem, you know, even you have Pelham, which is in a different county. But so the way I describe it is the district is from Derry to Portsmouth over to the Massachusetts border and everything in between.
That's big, big district. So why did you choose to run for that? How does that fit the things that you care about? I mean, you could have run for state rep or state senate. Why the executive council?
So I'm glad you asked. A couple of reasons. I think it ties in nicely with my skill sets. I've spent nearly 10 years working in healthcare staffing. I recruit and hire doctors, and we place them throughout the country. I run a $30 million healthcare division. So I'm an expert on hiring people, which is, you know, the executive council appoints people. Those, the same type of questioning and the same type of methodology with regards to finding the right person, making sure they're worthy and well qualified, digging into, you know, their past is very, very important for the executive council position. And the other skill set, which is extremely important that I bring to the table, is as a division manager, you know, I spend a large part of each and every day reviewing and looking at contracts with, you know, major hospitals, home health agencies, skilled nursing facilities, you know, throughout the country, some of our biggest and brightest facilities. And again, that is, as I mentioned earlier, the executive council approves and looks at any contract over $10,000. So those two skill sets make it a natural fit. Also, serving on the town council in Derry, the fourth largest community in the state, you know, it's very similar to being at this, you know, the executive council. So it made sense for me from a skill set purpose. And I also think it's imperative that at this point in our state's history that we have representation sitting on this board who understands what's going on with substance misuse.
Right.
And who can speak appropriately and effectively to the governor, whoever that may be, about what's needed in the state to be able to move the state forward without just spending money needlessly.
Yeah, and it's a question of, I mean, this has always been a very, very tightly run state. I mean, I am always amazed and impressed with the state employees, how much they do with so little. I mean, the budgets are just cut all the time. But we have some real issues. And just for listeners, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is candidate for executive council in New Hampshire, Joshua Borden. Now, with regard to the probably what seems to be the biggest issue, the one that's getting a lot of headlines, the opioid crisis. It amazes me how opioids are so big these days. I just don't get it. But I was amazed recently that some elected officials have called for doing more of the same clearly failed policy. They call it Operation Granite Hammer. And that's just simply law enforcement doing more of the same, which it surprises me with our limited means that we're going that route again. What are your thoughts and what special perspective do you bring to the opioid crisis and what we can do about this horrible thing?
So first off and foremost, you know, I've been sober for nearly six years now from alcoholism.
That's great.
Although that is different than the opioid crisis, the underlying problem is the way our brain works. And I believe that this is a brain disease. It needs to be handled as such, as we would treat and think about someone who had diabetes or someone who had cancer. And I think what I believe is that we need to spend our time listening and working with the leaders in the recovery community, those people who have been at it each and every day for decades, doing great things with nearly no funding,
those
are the ones who we should be asking, what do you need? How can I help? Many of those leaders are not going to, you know, they're not going to tell you that they need all kinds of more money. What they need is, you know, assistance and opportunities to expand their programs. Currently, we are spending $39,000 a year to put people in prison.
Per person?
Per person.
Wow,
per year.
$39,000.
Many of these people that I've spoken with in the recovery community have said that it would cost less for some of these inmates to end up in a rehab facility, but there's no space. There's not enough beds.
Oh,
there's
wow.
not enough help. With regards to, you know, the failed policy that you brought up earlier, that's one piece of it. The first thing to do is listen to those on the ground, the leaders in the recovery community, and then to implement what they're asking for. But we can't just do one piece of it. We need education for the families. We need, you know, to listen to those on the ground level. We need our law enforcement to be active and to do things like what the chief of police in Gloucester is doing.
Which is what?
He's been not charging any. Basically, if I call in and I, you know, I've been using and I say, you know, my friend is overdosed.
Yeah.
The chief of police has said that will not be a criminal offense. If police officers come to help them and to help save their lives, they're not going to charge the person who made the call, which is. It's
makes
saving
sense.
Life.
My
and,
goodness, yeah.
you know, it, by saving their life, the idea is that they'll get another shot, and maybe that'll be their rock bottom, and maybe, you know, they can get help. And many people will say it's a choice. It's the parents' fault. It's the way these people were brought up. It's going to cost too much money. But let me tell you this. What's the cost of doing nothing? And I know about the cost of doing nothing because I've been around this district talking to families. You've got parents who are not ready to give up on their kids. And what they're doing is they're spending their life savings. They're mortgaging their properties. It's costing them a great deal of money because there's no places for them to go. So the cost to get them in to a facility, you know, is driven up. So we need to do better. That's the bottom line. You know, the idea of not changing, not adapting, leaving everything the same and just praying and hoping things are going to get better, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
It doesn't work in business. It's not going to work here in New Hampshire.
And we've all heard that old definition of insanity. I believe it was Einstein. I'm not sure who said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. We've been, you know, focusing on this one way for so long, and look where it's gotten us. And I think, I mean, you're right. People need help. And why is it that, you know, a family that... And the heroin crisis knows no class consciousness. I mean, people from the lower end of the income scale, higher end, doesn't matter. But why should people who, you know, whose families can afford to get treatment for their family members, why, you know, one life is not worth more than another? And it seems to me, I mean, so many answers to so many problems relate to keeping democracy alive. As you're saying, Joshua Borden, that people on the ground, people who know what they're doing. You don't want it all to come from the top down and just be imposed on people. People who are in the field, who are healthcare and social workers, you know, you need input from them, I would think. I don't know how much opportunity there is to take input on the governor's council, the executive council. Is it possible to do that? Is there the mechanism there, or is this something that might be kind of new? I'm just, again, people don't really know what the executive council is.
No, I get it. And I'll get into that in a second. I did want to mention opportunity. I love that word because through this crisis that New Hampshire is facing, there's been opportunities for those who are in recovery to help those who are in need, families who are suffering to meet other families who have made it. And there's, you know, hope and direction has been provided. You know, new organizations have popped up with little to no funding and who are literally giving their all because they know that things need to change. So it's brought a lot of good out of a lot of people, which is great. I think we need to step up and help those who are willing to take a stand. We need to help those out. We owe it to those who are losing loved ones literally by the day. It's unacceptable. It's completely unacceptable. We have the money. We have the know-how. We have the brains. We're the greatest country in the world. We live in one of the best states in the country. We can get this done. And again, what's the cost of doing nothing? As far as what you mentioned, you know, does the executive council have an opportunity to make, I guess what you're getting at, real change around this subject?
Yeah, it's because it's an executive board. It's not a legislative board. But
right.
Speak to those opportunities, if you would.
So I can only say how I would use the seat, you know, whether we have a Democrat or a Republican in office. I will be making sure that this remains front and center on his or her mind, and I will be making sure that I'm using my leverage and my voice to demand that more is done, and not, again, whatever is done efficiently, not just pulling numbers out of the air, not just throwing money into the wind, because that's not the answer. We need
really?
To listen to the people on the ground, ask them what works, analyze it, and then and get it done. Cut through the red tape and make sure it happens. I'm the type of leader who I'm a bully's bully when need to be, and I'm willing to raise awareness, and I'm going to raise hell around issues that I believe in, whether I can vote on it or not. Because if I'm speaking loud enough and consistent enough, hopefully somebody will
absolutely
start paying attention.
Absolutely. And I happen to be pretty good friends with a predecessor of yours. Ruth Griffin was executive counselor for a long, long time, a Republican, but a sane Republican.
Yes.
And she used the bully pulpit, as Teddy Roosevelt called it, to speak out about issues. She was a public servant, absolutely terrific public servant. And I think one can do that in the executive council. What are some of the concerns, aside from the opioid crisis, which is huge, it's just taking so many lives, and the approach we've been using so far isn't really working. In talking to citizens of the towns of the district, as I'm sure you're doing, and it's
sure.
a big district, what other concerns do you hear most?
I mean, the big thing that is on people's minds that I'm meeting with is, you know, the roads, the bridges, the infrastructure.
That was my guess.
We've got 153 state bridges that are on the red list.
Yikes.
And it's scary.
Oh, yeah.
And that means that they need major work. We've got to do more with that. You know, there's a lot of people are interested. 74% of the people in New Hampshire are interested in having commuter rail.
Yes.
You know, that's something that continuously gets thrown aside.
Yes.
It's not even where, you know, they won't even talk about it.
Yeah.
They won't even study it. We had federal funding a few years back that was coming to our state, if we wanted it, to study whether it would be a good idea or not, and we chose to not accept the money.
Unbelievable.
Another state has accepted that money. And
unbelievable.
They're doing whatever they're doing. That's, to me, that's, whether you're for rail or not, that's common sense.
Well, as has often been said, not by you, of course, if something makes good common sense, it'll probably never happen in Concord. But every now and then.
Well, I'm hopeful that, you know, I think we can turn that around.
Yeah.
I think the one hope I have is that on both sides of the aisle, because I, you know, being in Derry, I talk to and have a lot of respect for a lot of the Republicans that live in my district.
Oh, yeah.
And likewise, they have a respect for me. It's because I'm the type of leader who's going to focus on the issue rather than what's good for, you know, what's good for the party. I think people are tired of politics as usual. They want someone who's going to listen. They want someone who's going to be more than just words, someone who's going to act, and someone who's going to do what's right for a majority of the people.
Yeah, it can happen. Again, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive, and on this half, we have candidate for Executive Council, also known as Governor's Council, Joshua Borden, a young person, but you must be find it an interesting experience going around talking to people, listening to people in 32 towns. My goodness, that is a big district. And Derry, let's face it, I mean, politically speaking, and what me talk about politics, it could happen. It's a tough district. It's a very tough district for a Democrat. You are running as a Democrat. Now, the town of Derry is not known as being particularly liberal or democratic. How does your experience as town councilor in Derry make you a strong candidate for possibly winning this thing?
So we went through some major problems last year in Derry. We had four radical counselors at the time with radical mindsets that, you know, wanted to, they believed they were doing the right thing, but sure, they weren't listening to the majority of the citizens in the community. They cut the budget by astronomical numbers.
Wow.
They did it by closing a fire station, cutting police officers, firefighters, DPW workers, human resources director, and taking all of those overtime budgets and nearly slashing them in half.
Wow.
Despite the fact that people came out in the hundreds, were begging, pleading, yelling for them to not do that. I've been a counselor who's remained positive, who's been responsive, and most importantly, who's listened. And lastly, when I disagree with something, or if what I'm saying isn't on this, you know, in agreement with the person I'm talking to, I just tell them why and where I'm coming from. And I have found more often than not that people will say, you know what, I don't see it that way, but I appreciate your honesty and your willingness to have the courage to at least tell me where you're coming from. And it sounds simple, but apparently that's not happening or has been happening that much. And I hear that throughout the district. So, you know, people see me as someone who's go-getter because of the many things that I'm a part of, whether it's creating events for our veterans, creating events for local food pantries or for recovery centers. People see those things happening, and they know the lack of time I have. I have a family. I run for office. I'm holding an office, and I work full time. But it's so important to me, for my family, and for everyone in my community to see me leading by example. So many people will just talk.
Yeah. And I want to look again politically. I'm not sure who is running as a Republican in this seat. I believe my old person that sat next to me in the state Senate, Russell Prescott. Is that right?
Yes, he'll be running. He's declared. He's been anointed as the most likely to win the primary. There is another gentleman from Derry running, County Commissioner Kevin Coyle as well.
Don't know. But I know Russ Prescott, and he's what can I say? He's a nice guy. I like him personally. Boy, is he right wing! Oh my goodness! You know, it's nice to see him get out of the state senate. I agree, but folks, I'm a Democrat and a liberal. There, I said it. We don't want Russ Prescott in there. So what can people do if they're interested in getting in touch with you and following and possibly helping the campaign? It's got to cost a lot of money, which seems crazy, but it does.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about that. Whether it's costing me time or money, you know, it's definitely costing both. I knowingly accepted that when I signed up. I have no regrets. And, you know, people could go to my website. I encourage you to go to my website. It's Borden4NH.com. It's B-O-U-R-D-O-N-F-O-R-N-H.com. and I know this is going to sound crazy, and you might yell at me after, but people can call me on my cell, and I give that out to everybody. It's 603-998-2433. I actually want to hear from you, whether you agree with me or not, because that's what leadership is. We're doing lots of canvassing. You know, July 16th, we're going to be in Exeter. On the 17th, we're in Derry. On July 23rd, we're in Stratham. 24th, Portsmouth. You can see the schedule on the website.
And again, the website is Borden for New Hampshire?
Yeah, it's BORDONFORNH.com. Great. We just released an awesome video that was done by Steve Sanger out of Portsmouth. He did a great job with that video. I'm very proud of the message it sends. And I would encourage people to, you know, either find me on Facebook or find me on my website and check that out.
It's about public service. It really is. And I'm one of those who believes that public service is a very, very honorable thing. And this guy, I know Joshua Borden. I knew your uncle, Earl Borden, impressed the heck out of me. Wonderful. He was your uncle, right?
He was my great uncle. He was a lion. He fought for the middle class. He fought for the seniors.
Just a terrific guy.
He was the best.
Yeah, he really was. And I had the chance to know him a bit. There's the Borden Center up in Claremont, I believe it is, named after him. Anyway, great stuff. Well, thank you for being willing to serve. It's a good thing. It's an honorable thing. And I think I might vote for you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure serving. I would encourage everyone, whether you're signing up for the military or public service, serve in some way.
Yeah,
it's really important. It's something you should really consider doing. I'm having a great time out there,
and it's very rewarding.
It's nice to help people.
Yeah, it is. It's really rewarding. It really, really is. I know that I got that from what I did for 14 years, and hopefully doing it now. Thanks so much. Borden for New Hampshire is the website. Borden, F-O-R-N-H. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your service, and thanks for the opportunity, Bert.
All right. And we'll be back with a complete switch in focus. We'll be talking about a lawsuit against the Democratic National Committee right after this break. And this is a song called Politician. Jack Bruce. Jack Bruce, great bassist. Of course, he did it with Cream as well before. Politician. Well, politics is what we talk about here on Keeping Democracy Alive. I believe in the political process, in making it happen, and it's got to be fair. People care about fairness. They really do. And there's been a lot of concern raised this year about the Democratic, with a small d, process or not, in nominating our presumptive nominee, Hillary Clinton. Clearly she won fair and square some states, but there's an awful lot of questions about other states, about various different voter suppression, different counting irregularities. A lot has happened. And there is actually a lawsuit going forward against the Democratic National Committee. And I'm very pleased to have with us Jared Beck, a lawyer, to talk about this and explain what it is. Jared, what is this class action lawsuit all about, please?
Oh, hi, Bert, and thanks for having me on your show. Just to get right to it, last week we filed a class action lawsuit, on behalf of three classes of potential class members, including those who donated to the Bernie Sanders campaign, as well as DNC donors. And the case was filed against two defendants, the Democratic National Committee and Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And the essence of the case is that the Democratic National Committee was, from the beginning of the primary process, biased in favor of one candidate and one candidate alone, and that candidate is Secretary Clinton. And so what we've done is we've asserted claims for fraud, negligent misrepresentation, unjust enrichment, and other claims of that nature based on what we allege to be the fraudulent conduct of the DNC and Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Wow, that's some big stuff. To make a lawsuit like that, you got to have the goods, I would think. Of course, you're involved in the case. How strong do you think it is? Are there enough pieces of evidence to win the case, do you think?
Well, you know, we're at the pleading stage right now. And in order to plead a case like this in federal court, you have to have, as you put it well, you have to have a plausible basis for the claims. And in this case, we're alleging our a case based on what I would say are three sources of evidence. The first source is the Democratic National Committee's own charter, which requires it to take an impartial and
right.
even-handed approach
right.
To all of the nominees that are competing for the nomination.
Right.
The second source of evidence is repeated statements of Debbie Wasserman Schultz and other officials of the DNC reported in various media sources since the beginning of the primary, stating that the DNC was indeed neutral in the process. And the third source of evidence are documents that have come into the public domain recently, in
yes.
recent weeks, as a individual going by the name of Guccifer
yes.
2.0 is releasing documents that he claims to have hacked from the DNC's own computer networks. And these are internal DNC documents, or what appear to be internal DNC documents, showing that the DNC's whole strategy from the beginning, and at the time that Bernie Sanders, for example, had already announced his candidacy, that they were pursuing a calculated and directed strategy at elevating Hillary Clinton to the nomination. And we submit that that is just completely inconsistent with what the charter requires and what the DNC itself said it was doing since the beginning of the race.
This is fairly big stuff, and I have to ask, there's been rumors, actually, about this Guccifer 2.0 being dead in a Virginia jail cell. I don't think that's true. But can hacked documents be used as evidence? I'm just curious. I don't know about this realm of legal stuff.
Well, that's where the discovery process comes in. I would just say two points on that. Number one is that the DNC has admitted that it was hacked by hackers, and its own security firm, which it retained to conduct the investigation, concluded that there were actually two sets of Russian hackers affiliated with the Russian government who intruded the DNC's servers and made off, plausibly made off with documents. Now, so the DNC hasn't denied that. In fact, they've admitted it.
Uh-huh.
Number two is that for weeks now, the DNC has had every opportunity to comment on the authenticity of the documents which have appeared and are still appearing on the Guccifer 2.0 website. And anybody with an internet connection can go visit that website and examine them and look at what Guccifer is putting up there. And the DNC's had every opportunity to comment on whether those documents are authentic or not, and they've chosen not to do so. And so, as a lawyer, that consistent refusal to admit or deny speaks volumes.
Yeah.
So certainly we're at a very early stage in this lawsuit, but the whole point of discovery in litigation is to get at the truth.
Yes.
And we're confident that we'll have opportunity to conduct discovery in this case and get to the bottom of what was taken from the DNC's servers and what is in fact authentic evidence of what the DNC's conduct was.
Well, this is certainly big stuff. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, our guest for this part of the show is Jared Beck, who is the lead attorney in a case, class action lawsuit against the Democratic National Committee. Fascinating stuff. And that information, those hacked documents, that is, it's out there for sure. And they have not denied that they're for real. They've had every opportunity. What do those hacked documents show? What do they suggest?
Well, there's a number of documents there that are of interest. I think one in particular is especially eye-catching and concerning. It's a Word document that is titled Presidential Candidates, and it looks to be a memo that was authored to the Democratic National Committee. And in fact, that's what it says in the two line of the memo. And the subject line is 2016 GOP presidential candidates. And then when you look at the memo itself, it is a very explicit strategic framework authored, dated May 26, 2015. So in terms of time frame, this is already a month after Bernie Sanders has announced his candidacy. And it sets forth a strategy that very expressly is defined as protecting and advancing Hillary Clinton's presidential candidacy against attacks from the GOP candidates. Now, this is May 2015.
Wow.
At this point in time, according to the DNC's own charter, it should be doing everything possible to ensure that there is a neutral primary process and that the DNC and all of its employees are taking an even-handed approach,
yes,
an impartial approach,
yes,
to all of the candidates that are running or may be expected to run. I mean, this was very early, and some candidates hadn't even announced yet. But that's exactly what the DNC is not doing. In fact, it's putting its resources into constructing a strategy in the media. And a lot of this is about how the DNC worked with the media to present an image of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
But it's devoting all those resources to pushing Hillary Clinton. So it's completely at odds with what the DNC was supposed to be doing at the time.
And clearly, I mean, Bernie was in at the time, he had indicated, and you're right, there were other candidates as well at the time, and this is just, it's wrong for the DNC to pick and choose. And as reporters and analysis has proved, unquestionably, the media focus on Hillary Clinton and not work, not giving a fair shot to Bernie to get his media coverage, it had its effect. It really did. And now it looks like the DNC, you know, the one that, well, the image of justice is this woman blindfolded holding a scale. The idea, you can't put your thumb on the scale. You cannot put your thumb on the scale for there to be justice. And I think this lawsuit is alleging that the DNC, it did in fact put a heavy thumb on the scale for one candidate over the others. So what's your interest in this, and how does one become a plaintiff in the case?
Yes, so my interest in this is as a lawyer representing clients and potential class members in their claims against the defendants, which, as I said, it's the DNC and Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that the same principles that would apply to any lawsuit applies to this one as well. You know, we're going to do our best in court to pursue these claims and establish the evidence and have our day in court for our clients. You know, this is a class action, so, you know, the way class actions work is that certain individuals who are interested in participating actively in the case can do so as class representatives. We've established a special email account that for inquiries, so we can provide more information and papers on how to become involved as a class representative. The email address is dncfraud@jampac.us. And so if anybody is wants more information on how to be a class member, that's the email address too.
And we'll make sure to say that again, but does it cost money to participate in this? What is the cost?
No, there's no cost. It's a pure contingency basis, meaning that if there's no recovery, we don't get paid as attorneys.
Uh-huh. So for example, who would be an appropriate plaintiff to add to the class action suit? Who has potential standing in the lawsuit?
Right.
How could they show that they were harmed?
In terms of harm, you know, we've set out in the complaint three categories of standing that we believe we'll be able to establish. Number one is people that donated to the DNC in the past approximate year. And the reason we believe those folks have standing is because, you know, if you gave to the DNC you know, you did so believing that the DNC was following its own charter and not misleading the public, then you were defrauded. The second category of people is people who gave to the Bernie Sanders campaign, also believing that the DNC was running a fair and honest primary process. Those folks, we believe, have also been harmed by the DNC's conduct directly. Although I will say that I think the DNC's conduct harms everybody in this country because it harms the political process, and we as Americans have a right to free and fair elections. And so, you know, this goes beyond even the legal standing that you might find. But, you know, for purposes of this case, obviously I'm only talking about legal standing. And the third category of people is people who are registered Democrats. We have a claim that the Democratic National Committee breached its duty of care to the party's own members by not running a free and fair primary process, a process that would be neutral as to all the candidates, which is what's required under the committee's own charter.
Well, I can't help but think that many listeners are saying, hey, that's me. I either contributed to the DNC or to Bernie. I may have some standing. So if you could, once again, how can people get in touch with you to see if they're interested in becoming a plaintiff?
Yes. So the best way, if you want to contact us by email, is through the email address we've established. That's dncfraud@jampac.us. You're also more than welcome to call our office. That's 305-234-2060, and we'll be happy to discuss the case in further detail.
And how, what would it look like if justice were served in this case? What would a win look like, and how would that, you know, it's always, if there's harm, you know, that justice calls for being made whole again. So what would that look like?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, I'm a civil litigator by trade. And so usually in our lawsuits, harm can and is reduced to a monetary value. And that's how the civil system makes people whole. Now, this case, I have to say that this case is unusual because I don't think you can actually put a price on American democracy.
Really?
And I really do believe that the DNC's conduct has robbed us as Americans of maybe one of our most important, if not the most important, birthrights, which is our democratic system of government. So in terms of what changes or what could happen, that would be a win in this case. I mean, short of, you know, obviously we want to establish liability against the defendants for their conduct. I mean, that's the immediate goal. But in terms of the remedy, I really do think the remedy has to be something that ensures that this never happens again, and that the Democratic Party is held to its own charter. And so, you know, these may be institutional reforms that we're talking about. These may be rule changes that we're talking about. I don't know. I mean, you know, I think there's, you know, there's a lot that is fundamentally wrong with how our primaries and caucuses are conducted in this country.
Yes.
There's a lot that's wrong in terms of how easy it is to suppress voters.
Yes.
And there's a lot that's wrong in terms of how non-transparent the voting process is. And so there's a lot that needs to be done in those areas. Courts have powers,
yes,
broad powers, to fashion appropriate equitable remedies in appropriate circumstances. And I would say, even though we're at a very early stage of this case and a lot needs to be forged as we go through the litigation process, I would say that this is a case that calls out for such equitable remedies.
I would think so. And, you know, lawyers always anticipate what the other side is going to say. What's the other side going to say?
You know, I have no idea at this point. You know, we served the complaint end of last week, so they have 21 days from the date of service to respond, and at this point in time, you know, it's anybody's guess what kind of response we'll get.
Could they just ignore it and hope it goes away?
Well, if they ignore it, that would be a great risk, because they would, you know, that would put them in a position of of having a default judgment entered against them, and I don't think they'd want that.
Yeah.
So I would expect that they will show up, and I would expect that we'll get a response from them. What that response will be, I have no idea.
And what of significance happened on June 15th, 2016? There was something that affects this case.
What happened on June 15th? 2016?
Yes.
I mean, I think that that was trying to, I think that was the date that the Guccifer leaks came out.
Yeah, I think it was too. I wasn't.
I think it, I know that he started releasing documents in mid-June of this year. So I believe that's when the very first the very first leak came out.
And documents are documents. They are, you know, they are actual pieces of evidence that I would think a court, you know, if it does go to court, and well, I wonder what court would likely hear this case.
Well, we filed it in the Southern District of Florida.
So, uh-huh.
You know, that's our initial choice of venue,
sure.
And that's where it is at the moment.
And I have to ask, you know, about any risk, any political risk that there may be for people becoming plaintiffs. Like, the question has been raised about can Bernie Sanders delegates be plaintiffs, or is there a risk of those delegates being decredentialed? What do you know about that concern?
Well, I have seen public reports of that risk out there, and we have in the complaint that we filed, we had class representatives in that position, and so, you know, we've had attorney client discussions with them, and I can't get
uh-huh.
into those because those are confidential.
Sure.
But I can tell you that we are actively dealing with that issue now.
Well, I hope so, because I am a delegate for Bernie Sanders, and I would like to see a fair process go forward. I am exceedingly displeased with the DNC tipping the scales on behalf of one candidate. I don't know if there's a precedent for that, but it bothers the heck out of me. And so what about, I mean, we like to believe that democracy results in legitimate candidates. In 1876, the election then was highly questionable as to whether it was a legitimate outcome. It seems that a lot of money was paid, the military was sent in, and was the president actually legitimately elected? Still open to question. If, and it looks likely that she will be, if Hillary does become the party nominee, what about that legitimacy? Would it be a questionably legitimate nomination based on what you know, what the documents show?
Well, that's a good question. I think when, you know, we talk about the legitimacy of an election, you know, that's another type of legal claim that is outside of what we're alleging in this lawsuit.
Right.
And so I want to be clear on that at
sure.
the outset. As to, you know, the question in and of itself, which is, you know, what does this mean for the legitimacy of our elections? Well, I think it's, it's self-evidently bad for a country that prides itself on being a democracy to have so little confidence in the democratic character of its institutions. And I would submit that this election, at least in my lifetime, it seems to be at the limit case of just the sheer amount of anger and distrust that people have in the electoral process. That's not to say there aren't other times in American history that we've also had a significant amount of distrust in the process, but, you know, we've also had some very troubled times in American history. So that, you know, that's not necessarily a good thing. I would say that, that is something that, you know, I don't know that a legal remedy can restore trust in our elections. I think that's something that the people have to do, and the people ultimately have to demand a change in our process and make a fundamental political transformation.
But this has got to
be the only way that's going to happen.
This has got to be an important part of that in saying, hey, you know, here's the documentation. You
right.
tipped the scales. That you did not play by your own rules and cut it out. So,
right.
you know, I would think that this would be a legitimate part of the process. How many plaintiffs are there so far, and how fast is it growing?
Well, we have we have a complaint that has 120 class representatives named, which is actually only a small fraction of the folks who have signed retainers agreements with us. I believe that it's at last count, which was honestly a couple days ago, it was over 1,000, and I'm sure it's grown since we've just continued to have floods and floods of emails coming in from people and phone calls and what have you wanting to be a part. I mean, the sheer outpouring of support for this lawsuit is, you know, unprecedented in my career doing class actions. I've never seen so much support at the initial stage of a lawsuit from people in the proposed class is actually, you know, contacting the lawyers and saying, "I want to be a part of this." So it's truly truly amazing to see that.
Well, people are amazed at how rigged it appears to be, and how many ways it's been rigged. I mean, there's one site on Facebook, something, I think it's called the Clinton Coup d'Etat, something like that. There's a lot of anger out there. A lot of Americans who believe in democracy feel like they've been harmed, directly harmed. And so, you know, it's going forward. So one final time, if people are interested in possibly becoming a plaintiff, it doesn't cost you anything. What's the website? How can you direct them on that electronic world out there?
Yeah, so if you want to get papers about the lawsuit and you want to actively participate as a class representative, the best thing to do is to email dncfraud@jampac.us. You can also, I mean, if you search on Google, you'll find a number of, we've established a Facebook page. There's also information on the website, jampac.us, which talks about the lawsuit. And we are posting documents from the case as they become available, and we're posting updates, and I'm, you know, posting videos that update on the process, because, you know, one of the one of the important things about this case is that it is so connected to our political process and so connected to this the contentious issues that have really come to the fore in this election. And so having a real dialogue with the people that are affected by the DNC's conduct and that have been harmed and that are in the proposed classes, having a dialogue with us as attorneys is really important. And, of course, since there's so many people out there, you know, we're finding social media as a real benefit for us to not only update people about the lawsuit, but to hear from people and hear what their concerns are, because that's ultimately, this lawsuit will only be as strong as and as impactful as the clients who are
participating,
on whose half it's being brought.
Well, thank you very much for doing this, and it's going to be a very interesting process. We'll see if we can get some justice. Jared Beck, thanks so much.
Thank you, Bert. Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.